Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Ask Dr. Death podcast with your hosts, Dr. Karen Wyatt and Dr. Terry Daniel. This is the place to ask the tough questions about tough topics related to death, dying, and grieving. Here you'll find candid conversations about things that aren't normally discussed in polite society. If you have questions for your doctor, your grief counselor, your professor, your pastor, or your guru, we'll try to tackle it for you. Our interview guests include experts in a wide range of disciplines related to death, dying, and bereavement, including doctors, counselors, psychic mediums, scientists, shamans, and even people who are themselves facing imminent death. Got a question you'd like us to address? Send an email to askdrdeath@gmail.com, and we'll try to tackle it in an upcoming episode. So, without further ado, since we're all living on borrowed time, let's get started.
Hey, everybody, here we are with Dr. Death. We only have me, Dr. Terry Daniel, today. My partner, Karen Wyatt, is not with us at the moment, but I am with three of my favorite people in the entire world, best known to many of us as Uncle Dan, Uncle Doug, and Uncle Mark of the How To Heretics, also known as the Unholy Trinity.
Hello, and I, only by those who know us really
only yes. And I found these guys through another friend who has a podcast called the Mind Shift Podcast. His name is Dr. Clint Haycock, and I've got a interview with him as well. And he said to me, you need to listen to the How To Heretics. So he did that. He connected us. So I found these guys. This is how I describe them to my friends and colleagues. Three incredibly brilliant and funny ex-Mormon guys, more or less in their 40s, as much as I can tell.
Let's go with that.
Sure.
who do amazing research and into all the weirdest shit that happens in the weirdest religions. And I invited them here today to talk about the weirdest shit that happens in Mormonism about death. I'm going to let them each just kind of introduce themselves and say hello. So take it away, guys.
I'm Mark. I'm the cute one and the funny one, and I am also the oldest of the group, and I'm the gay one. So, and then I'll let the two young whippersnapper heterosexuals talk.
Well, if it doesn't sound like it, Mark and I are brothers. I'm Doug. I'm Uncle Doug, and I'm Mark's youngest brother. He's only your little brother. Yeah. And I'm also the bad boy of the group, so I don't know what that leaves for Dan, but there you go.
I don't even know what's left. I'm Dan, and I'm not actually related to these guys, and much to my chagrin. I feel like
he's a brother from another mother.
Indeed. And I started another podcast called Thank God I'm Atheist, and these guys were we all sort of met each other through that, and these guys have both co-hosted on that, and we just decided we needed our own show.
Yeah. So Dan's the senior podcaster. His show's been on for fucking how long, Dan?
Oh man,
400 and something episodes.
Seven years or eight?
Yeah.
Nine years. I think it's 9 years now. Wow. I don't know. Time is a flat circle. I don't have a sense of how that works.
Yeah.
A while now.
Yeah, and we just try. You know, in our show, we try to. There's a lot of very strident atheist podcasting out there, because anger is obviously a huge component of leaving religion for a lot of people. And we probably have our strident moments, but for the most part, we wanted to aim to create a safe landing space for people who are newly out of whatever faith, like, and whatever it is, just to kind of help them find their feet and figure out how to live sanely and happily in a post-religious world.
Yeah. And there are so many closets for us to be coming out of right now, you know, and the atheist closet is a really big one. Yeah. And I find that, I mean, not just in the Christian world, but in the woo-woo world. And I think if you scratch the surface of so many woo people, you will find out that, well, and this is kind of jumping right into what we're going to talk about, the definition of atheism is that, you know, they don't believe in religious doctrine and dogma, obviously not the God in the sky Judeo-Christian thing. Is that the definition of atheism? I'm sorry, I just jumped so straight right into that. But
no, that's fine.
Yeah, so let's go there. But before we do, I just want to say that it took me a really long time, Mark and Doug, to tell the difference between your two voices.
I know. You know what? When we were in contact with our parents, which we aren't anymore, and that's a story we won't even get into because it's a religious
situation. I'd love to hear that situation. Story, but not if you don't want to.
We can do it another. Oh, well, tell it. But you know, we don't want to waste any time with it tonight. But our parents, when we were still in contact with them, couldn't tell us apart on the phone.
Yeah.
So why don't we do a podcast together? Great
exactly.
idea.
Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant
I'm idea. Learning how to tell you apart because Mark, well, Doug is lower, a little gravelier.
Right.
Yep.
A little, and Mark has got a little tiny bit of a nasal thing going on.
I have quite comparison.
I don't know if you've seen his nose, but it's not a tiny nasal thing.
cute nose.
I look like I'm wearing one of those Groucho Marx things that you used to buy at the novelty shop.
That's right.
Yeah, but I'm not.
Well, we don't get to see what you look like very often because you're audio uncles. And so
I'm like the great pumpkin. I only come out once a year.
Well, it's been so great to be in your Zoom things because now all your fans get to see what you look like.
Yeah,
well, those have been fun. We've been blessed with faces for radio. That's true.
Oh, that's how it works. Okay. Yeah, well, why don't we just jump in? You said something about angry atheists, and I don't want to talk too much because I want you guys to talk, but I am going to tell you a little story. Many years ago, I was on the board of the American Humanist Association, which is part of Freedom From Religion Foundation, Citizens United Against Separation Church or for Separation of Church and State, whatever it is. And I was pretty hardcore with them. I was on their board. And I agreed to their humanist manifesto, which said that we do not believe in anything beyond the physical, material, provable scientific world. There's nothing beyond this dimension. And I didn't really agree with that, but I wanted to be on their board because I wanted to really fight for separation of church and state. That's why I was there. And many, many years passed by and I wrote a book about the possibility of communicating to beings across dimensions. And they called me up and they said, "We don't believe in that. Do you really?" And I said, "Yeah, I kind of do." And they said, "Well, then you can't be on our board anymore."
Wow.
Yeah, they're sticklers, those guys.
Yeah, they are. And I was also ordained as one of their humanist ministers and they took that away too. So I'm a defrocked, excommunicated humanist.
They tore off your shoulder boards and broke your saber.
Yes, they did.
Wow, it's dramatic. Yes.
Yeah, so I'm, you know, I'm there with atheism because to me it doesn't mean what they say. It doesn't mean that there's only this physical empirical dimension. That's what their definition is. And my definition is there's no gods or God or literal interpretations of sacred texts or any of that doctrine stuff, but there are other dimensions of consciousness that we can experience. So I'm going to just turn that over to you guys and you tell me what you think.
Well, you had asked before about the idea of what is an atheist. You had mentioned that just sort of getting that definition out of the way. And I think that it's helpful to look at it from the perspective of the actual origin of the word Greek. You know, it comes from the Greek, a meaning without and theos meaning God. And for me, and different people define the words differently, you know, English is a living language and nobody gets to be the final arbiter on what any word means. But for me, all atheism means and all atheist means is that you lack a specific belief in a specific God. And so that certainly applies to me. I don't have any God belief. I personally don't, I choose to live my life in a way where I don't establish belief about anything for which I don't see ample evidence. That doesn't mean that I don't think that it's possible or that I think that something's impossible. It means that until I have what I would consider to be true and worthy evidence, I don't establish a belief one way or the other. Depending on what it is, I may not place the same amount of weight on it being true or that I do on it being false. For instance, you know, if someone posits that there's a, you know, a flying spaghetti monster, for example, I'm probably going to say that that's far less likely to be true than it's likely, or than you know, so the weighting is not the same, but that doesn't mean that I discount the possibility entirely. I just opt out of believing one way or the other.
Well, and I think that, you know, one of the things that
this is Doug talking, by the way,
this is Doug. Hello.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we're doing this podcast in the first place is because I think a life free from the shackles of, you know, very silly and potentially problematic beliefs is a good life. And a lot of atheists, when they find their way out of those prisons, are very angry. And there's a lot of content that speaks to that anger. But one of the things I, you know, and we're trying to give some content to the good life part of that equation. But one of the things I like best about being, you know, so-called atheist is there's no orthodoxy. There's no clergy. No one can tell me what to do. And no one can tell me.
Yeah, we don't have a pope.
Yeah, we don't have a pope. And I love that. I don't have to go to meetings, even though I go to one every Sunday with my two audio uncles with a podcast.
I thought you were talking about AA.
Yeah.
No, I don't do that anymore. They don't let you go drunk, which I think is a big mistake. But
I want to talk to you about that, about alcohol in Utah. We'll get there.
Yeah.
But when I was first kind of as an atheist, and I agree with Dan, it's just not believing in a thing, which is kind of hard to you know, wrap your arms around a collective of people who don't believe a thing. I was very concerned.
It's like a group of people who all don't believe in astrology.
Right. It's like not collecting stamps is not a hobby.
Right. Exactly. Right. But I was very concerned about definitions, you know, with the different degrees of atheism and atheism versus agnosticism and atheism versus skepticism. And I've since, and a lot of this has happened through the course of this podcast, started to look at those discussions as kind of an atheist version of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. That we don't really, it doesn't, you know, it's not the end of the world how we define what we don't believe in. And right. So just kind of putting that marker down that I think the term, spending a lot of time trying to define what is or is not atheist versus agnostic is not sometimes the most productive use of time.
And also, we're all of those things. All three of us are atheists and agnostics and skeptics. Like these aren't either or situations.
And this is Mark again. I would say, you know, I'd go back to what you were saying, Terry, about how you were kind of defrocked and you had to sign a pledge you weren't exactly comfortable with that made demands that I don't think they were in a position to actually make because they don't know that, right?
Right.
Like,
it's an interesting point. I mean, the fact that they have something called the Humanist Manifesto is scary. And
right.
They've revised it three times now over the last 80 years or however they're...
At least they're allowed to revise. You know what I mean? You look at a dogmatic religion and everything has to be set in stone or something cataclysmic has to happen for it to change. At very least, they're in a place where they know that they can do revision that's needed.
I can't say there aren't other dimensions, as you said, Terry, because I don't know. Every evidence I've ever examined and every truth claim I've ever examined on the show and in my life from these dogmatic religions like Mormonism and Scientology and Catholicism and you just, you know, name it, has not penciled out. Like, those claims don't actually work. So you start building a preponderance of evidence for supernatural claims and, you know, statistically you see, well, it's less likely for these, the next claim to be true. But if I'm being honest, of course I'm an agnostic because I can't say for certain that the Book of Revelation is not an actual news report from the future. But based on the evidence we have about the Book of Revelation, how it was written at the time it was written, the political forces it was describing, you know, in the Mediterranean basin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it is not a news report from the future as far as the evidence points.
Yeah, well, it's the ravings of a lunatic, you know, as so many of these mystical experiences are. And this is something I teach a lot in my classes, that, you know, human beings of various types across cultures and throughout history have been having visions and mystical experiences in all the different religious traditions. Yeah. In the Christian traditions, you know, you have loonies like Ezekiel and John of Patmos, right? Yeah. But in all the traditions, there is this. And there are, you know, not only men, but women who've had these visions. So many of them, I think, are having some sort of transcendent journey of some kind. And a lot of them are just fucking insane.
Sure. And they're trying to, you know, if you have some kind of, let's say, just for the purposes of illustration, a schizophrenic episode, but you have it 4,000 years ago.
Right.
Right. How do you explain that? How do
that
you explain?
Once I did have 4,000 years ago. Yeah. It was weird.
How do you make sense of that? How do you say, oh, there's, I'm having a misfire of brain chemistry, or I have a structural problem in my brain. This is just a normal part of that experience. No, it's an ecstatic vision of angels or demons or, you know, that sort of thing. So that, I think a huge amount of both dogmatic religious and, you know, woo sort of explanations are some of them are really an earnest attempt to make sense out of a frightening natural world in a time when there weren't really good ways to explain the natural world.
It's, well, the failure is we have those explanations now.
We have a hell of a lot more.
Right. We know why the sun rises and sets, and we know why the seasons change. And there was a time we didn't. And so we made up reasons. And, you know, we really need to cast off those old, but I'll say this to your point, Mark, too. I'm skeptical because I've been burned. You know, I'm skeptical of fantastical claims because I've been lied to, and I gave a significant portion of my life and a lot of money that I'll never get back to people who were lying to me on purpose. And
they keep the money. I'd rather have the time, but I can't get that back.
Truly. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a lot of something I noticed about the people in the Humanist Association is they were angry atheists, and mm-hmm. they had been raised in religious cults to various degrees of, with various degrees of religious abuse. And so understandably they were wounded.
Yep. Yeah.
And they didn't really have a way to process that. So just kind of being angry at anything interdimensional might be one way to do it. But it's interesting about agnostic and atheist. So Gnostic means knowledge, and, you know, it means without the historical spiritual knowledge, or atheist means without theos, without God. But I think a lot about, you know, some, like one of the definitions, Mark, of how we define these interdimensional experiences, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatric Mental Disorders, yeah. actually has definitions for this that match what we see, and I've worked in hospitals and seen many people having near-death experiences, match what people experience in these out-of-body journeys. Mm. And so there's actually a chart, you know, that says if a person reports leaving their body, feeling a sense of separation, like one part of them is over here and one part is over there, or they see their body laying on the table, or perhaps they meet with dead relatives or see celestial beings or whatever, this fits the criteria for, you know, visual and auditory hallucinations, schizoid disorder, blah, blah, blah. So people who have these experiences in the hospital don't report them because they're going to go straight to the psych evaluation. I've seen it happen a whole bunch
right.
of times. So one of the criteria that they use is if these experiences are not a good match with the experiences of same culture peers, then it is considered psychotic.
Interesting.
Yeah. So same culture peers is a really interesting term. So if you lived in Tibet and you had an experience like this, your same culture peers would find this perfectly normal.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. But that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's interesting to see how they define it and how culturally subjective it can be.
Do you feel, I'm curious if you feel like the fact that a near-death experience, the near-death experience is defined culturally, that different cultures have their own near-death experience. To my mind, that speaks to this is a fabrication of their own brain, that they right. that they're sort of their brain is playing out something.
It's an internal rather than external experience. Yeah.
Is that not how you interpret that?
It's 100% culturally influenced. And there's been research on that. That's really interesting. And you've probably heard, you know, heavy duty Christians, they see the pearly gates and the golden streets, and the woo woo people see the light and the love and everything. And so the thing that's baffling about it is, how can it be brain activity when there's no brain activity? And the definition of clinical death now used to be 30, 40 years ago, no more respiration, no more breath, no more heartbeat. But now we can fake a heartbeat and we can fake breath. So the clinical definition of death now is flatline brain activity, no electrical juice to the brain. So if there's no electrical juice to the brain, how can these be hallucinations and brains? I'm not saying I have the answer. I don't know. And something I like to say a lot is, I spent 10 years in theology school, and the one thing I learned is how to say, I don't know.
Well, that's a good thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fortunately, the three of us are brain scientists, so we do have the answers.
I spend most of my time in that flatline region. So, but here's a question I had. So Dr. Terry, you sent us some reading material that we're probably going to get into, but I don't personally know a ton about near-death experiences, and I love this conversation, but my take from what I read and what you sent is that the timeline of these quote memories is quite long. So I'm just wondering if there's research about how long a person is clinically dead, or, you know, before they're revived. You know, the way that dreams maybe only take a few seconds in our unconscious state, but they seem like they might be an hour long.
Right.
You know, how long is it when a person goes and meets dead relatives and has conversations with them and sees all sorts of visions and things? How long are they actually, is there research about how long they're actually, quote, dead?
There is. And they're usually not dead for very long, because you can't leave a person dead for very long. So I don't know the actual numbers, but a few minutes, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, you know. And the other thing is, when you resuscitate a person after they're have stopped being oxygen to the brain and the brain is not having any electrical activity, there's brain damage.
Right.
Every time you bring a person back from that, they have less of a brain.
That's why I've stopped bringing Doug back from the dead. I'm just like, this is getting ridiculous.
Although, please, I keep saying we should shoot for 8 minutes, Doug. We need to go for the record.
Well, remember that movie Flatliners
from the
80s? I haven't seen it in a long time. But isn't that what they did?
Yeah, they kept going for longer and longer times, and then they got haunted.
They brought stuff back with them.
Yeah, then they brought all this, you know, all this bullshit doctrine into it.
Yeah. You need your DNR like written on your forehead, Doug, so I won't forget.
Well, there are people who actually tattoo it on their chest.
I think that's a great idea.
Brilliant idea. So then when they open your shirt and give you CPR, it's right there.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm going to start tattooing it on people I don't like.
Just give them some drugs, knock them out, and do that. So yeah, this is just so interesting. So there's some real interesting research on, you know, how the religious landscape of America is changing, and people are moving away from organized religion. And one way that they define it is the old format, say, let's just pick a time from history, it could be anywhere up until the 1960s, was belief, behave, belong. Have you ever heard that?
Mm-mm.
So first you have to believe the narrative.
Yeah.
Then you have to behave according to the rules. And when you do those two things, then you belong.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. That makes sense.
It sounds insidious when you say it like that.
It is insidious. And so the guy who did that research is a guy named Harvey Cox, C-O-X. And his work is really interesting. And so now what some of the theologians are saying is, we're kind of moving into a space now where we start out with belonging and then behaving and then maybe believing. So belonging means you find a community that sort of thinks the same, kind of like the how-to heretics, and we start with belonging. And then we kind of move into behaving, which is coming out of the atheist closet. perhaps, you know, speaking our mind, leaving our religion, taking actions to behave a certain way. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, what was the other one?
Believe it.
Believing
and belief. And then we believe what we really believe in our really in our real hearts.
Terry, I feel like you're telling us to start a cult. I'm not sure, but I feel like you're saying like we've already got them two steps in. We might as well take that third step.
Oh, it's way more money than podcasting.
Yeah,
way,
and who better than us to do a cult, right? Like, I don't think there's a few people alive that have read about as many cults as we have.
Yeah, so, exactly. So let's use that as a segue. Let's talk about Mormonism.
Yeah.
Let's go there. Speaking of cults.
Sorry, everybody. Here it comes.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was going to say, and it goes back to my Mormon upbringing, that I very clearly remember, and I think the other uncles do probably too, that we were taught that if you were having doubts or problems believing in a certain doctrine or a certain part of the church, you were just told to stop, to put your doubts aside and believe it harder.
They say doubt your doubts before you doubt your faith.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a house of cards because the human mind can't really do that forever. Or if it does, it's going to cause damage, psychological damage. But I remember hearing that all the time as a young Mormon. It's like, oh, you know, if you ever have a doubt, just put it in the back of your mind, put it on your shelf. Don't think about it.
Don't think, period.
Yeah. Try harder, believe harder. Yeah. Believe harder. Here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's my whole thing has been, I have become anti-belief. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it earlier. I feel like belief is where you get into trouble. I don't think we need it. I think there's stuff out there that we know is real, you know, because we've experienced it, because we, you know, it, or because it's been shown by a preponderance of evidence. And for the rest of it, it's okay to just not know. But the second you start to establish beliefs that aren't supported by evidence, or beliefs that aren't that are based in that on guesswork or on emotions or on what will make me most comforted or whatever, that's when you're in trouble, because your psyche needs to defend those beliefs.
Because beliefs are attachments. Beliefs are calcified.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And there's, you know, the world, the natural world, and what we understand about it and each other and humanity, there's so much there to work with. Yeah. There's so much great fucking material to work with to build an incredible system of morality and decency. We don't need, you know, I just don't think we need to pretend. I think we have what we need to build a beautiful world for ourselves and for other people without going through the looking glass.
This whole, it's so funny how people find out that you're an atheist and they think, well, I hear all the time, don't you believe in something bigger than yourself? And I just point to almost everything.
All of the it.
Look at how much bigger it is than me. I don't
walk outside at night and look up.
Yeah, I don't need anything pretend to, like, you know, Jupiter is way bigger than me, and the Earth is way bigger than me, and a bear is bigger than me.
I don't need anything
that I can't observe to have wonder and awe and experience majesty.
Yeah, I told the story on the podcast about when I went up to Idaho to see the eclipse. What was that now? How many years ago was that?
A couple years.
10,000.
Yeah. I fucking knows, right?
But I saw it. I went up to Stanley, Idaho, and I was right in the vector.
Totality,
amazing. An unbelievable experience. And I was so grateful that I got to experience that without having to try and cram it into some stupid theology or explain it away that, oh, God did this and God made the sun and the moon proportionally the same size. Fuck that shit. I got to witness it.
We swear a lot, Terry. I hope that's okay on your podcast.
It's okay. Absolutely fucking okay. I do.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Yeah.
But just to be able to sit and look at that thing happen and see it from the perspective of not religion was
And it must really be so great. Weird to, you know, have grown up in a religious indoctrination where you're told that God made the sun on the fourth day.
Right. Yeah.
But
there was already light.
Day and night. Yeah,
exactly.
The plants and animals were doing just fine. They didn't need it.
Genesis has only had 3,000 years to get an editor.
Well, you know, the people who tout the Bible the loudest are the ones who've read it the least.
Of course.
Because, you know, if you tell any of them that Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 tells a completely different contradictory story, they won't even hear They've you say that. And you just say, like, it's here. It's right here in the fucking book. Just look at it.
I know. Exactly.
Just take notes. As you're reading,
nobody reads the Bible like atheists.
You'll be amazed at what you read. Yeah.
So
that's
if you
right,
want,
Doug. Yeah, I guess I've heard you say that before. A lot of people say that no one reads the Bible like atheists. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know?
We read it as an act of self-defense.
Yeah.
Yes, and also because we know that we have to argue with people about
it.
Or take a stand and have a position. So I mean, that's the whole reason I went back to school and got these degrees in religious studies and shit, because I had patients in hospice who were Christians, and I had to know how to talk to them, not to talk them out of their beliefs, but to try to understand it in a way so that I could help them, because I've had so many people on their deathbeds just freaking out, thinking that they were going to hell because they were gay or because they were divorced or whatever, the thing was.
And it breaks my heart.
Oh, it's just horrible. I mean, I don't think you see it anywhere else worse than in end of life care.
Sure.
Because people just kind of cruise through their life with these beliefs that they were given when they were 5 years old, and they never think about it again. They just go, okay, yeah, there's heaven and hell and God judges us and whatever. And then until they're faced with a crisis, it never comes up for examination.
Wow. That must be terrifying. I can't imagine how that must be.
It's pretty terrifying.
None of us know what's on the other side of that veil, so to speak. And no one can tell us that, but it must be very terrifying when you get to that point where you're going to find out and your only frame of reference is some really terrible shit your parents told you.
So it's really interesting the way they train us as chaplains. And, I guess if I was being really honest, I would call myself an atheist chaplain. Mm-hmm. Is when somebody says that, like, I was a bad person my whole life. I was a sinner. I'm dying. I'm so afraid I'm going to go to hell. What am I supposed to say to him? What I want to say is, it's all bullshit. There is no hell. You've been lied to all your life.
You can't do that, right?
No, I'm not allowed to do that. So what they train us to do is to say to the person, well, Johnny, tell me about your faith. And then let him tell me the whole bullshit story that he has. And what he'll end up saying is, well, so if I accept Jesus, then I'm saved and I'll go to heaven. So I'll say to him, well, did you accept Jesus? Well, yeah, I did. And I will say, well, dude, you're good to go.
You're set.
What are you worried about?
Rock and roll, baby.
Yeah. Wow.
Go ahead.
It's a hell of a mind fuck to have been given a set of beliefs about what's going to happen to you. And then, death is a mind fuck no matter how you slice it. It's not like it's any easier for atheists. It may be harder. It may be that a lot of believers take genuine comfort in the afterlife. But as you're describing, a lot of believers, most dogmatic churches spend your entire life telling you that you're a sinner and that sinners go to hell.
It seems for them, there's a lot of terror built around it. And I'm the oldest of the three. These guys are gunning for my position. I don't know to trust a drink they ever give me. It's coming. And I'm going to be scared to death, I'm sure. I don't want to die. I'm less worried about what's on the other side. I'm scared about dying, really, rather than...
The signature on Mark's DNR looks suspiciously like my signature.
So what's scary about dying? Is it like leaving the things that are familiar and comfortable and loved?
Yeah. I mean, I love my life. I have a beautiful life. I'm despite some terrible shit in my upbringing, like the life I built for myself after leaving religion and leaving my family is miraculous. It's incredible. It's gorgeous. And so, I don't want to leave it, but at the same time, I don't want to live forever. Like, I'm not one of those people who's like, a transhumanist that wants my consciousness downloaded into some kind of machine. It's like, I'm just an animal on this earth, like every other animal on this earth. And at some point my time's going to be up.
A brain in a box.
A brain in a box. So yeah. I don't know. Let's talk again when I die. We'll figure it out.
if you guys have a chance to watch this movie that's on Netflix right now, it's called Hope Frozen. Have you heard of this?
No.
It's about this family in Thailand whose little kid, 2 years old, dies. And they have her frozen at this place in Arizona. I think it's called Alcor, where they freeze people. And it turns out they actually had her head cut off from her body. And her brain is frozen in this capsule, and they go there and they do like prayers and rituals and stuff. And they actually intend to bring this child's head back someday, attach it to a body.
Happy birthday, kiddo.
It's insane. It's a documentary. This is not science fiction. So it's on Netflix right now. If you want to watch it, it'd be a great thing to talk about in a show. It's called, Hope
for sure.
Well, and you think about the. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, Doug.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, you look at the lengths that a wounded animal will go to survive, and a cornered animal will go to fight off a predator. We are programmed by evolution over the course of billions of years to want to survive. It's imperative within us. So, of course, when we achieved consciousness, a fear of death would come with that. You know, I mean, a jellyfish, maybe that's not the right example, but a shark is afraid of dying. It just doesn't have the consciousness to articulate that. And it fights for its life with every breath it takes. As do we just have consciousness to add to the dread. And so I think it's only natural that we fear death. We're supposed to fear death. Death is staring you in the face, it's hard to imagine feeling anything but fear.
Yeah, I think there's also a sense, because Mark, you talked about, you know, how great your life is and not wanting to let go of that. But I mean, a lot of really miserable people hang on to their lives for a long time. I don't think it's just about that. You know, Shakespeare,
it just is my circumstance. Yeah, but sure.
Yeah.
But people who have terrible lives talked about the idea of
it's just that undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns puzzles the will. You know, it's just such a baffling concept.
Nerd.
Yeah, I know, right? I could go on with
nerd thing.
Do you want
me
to keep going?
Yeah, I know you can.
It's but it's this idea that I don't think you have to love your life to not want to die. Because it's just because I think no matter what, even if you have a belief that you're convinced you're 100% sure about. If that were true, if you were 100% sure that you're going to go to heaven after you die and it's all going to be fine, you would feel no fear. But that's not the case. It's not a personal life that it is 100%
sure. Yeah, Terry, in your experience, like, I don't know how many avowed atheists you've sat by their bedside versus how many, you know, deep religious believers. Do you have any anecdotal experience with how...
That's a really good question. And the people I have found who were the least afraid of death were the spiritual but not religious types, Buddhists and pagans and woo-woos of various stripes.
Right.
I have found a hardcore atheists to be very, very scared of death because it's the unknown.
Right.
That very thing that we value, which is the ability to say, I don't know, is the very thing that is scary. Mm. So one thing that we do know, I think, about humans is that we tend to want to make meaning out of stuff. That's why we have religion. That's why we created it. So everything that happened, like the crops died, leopard came into the village and ate the baby, whatever happens, we have this need to assign some sort of meaning to it. And from that, we've created all these, you know, religious constructs. So I think when we're facing death, which is, I think, the... death is the reason religion was created in the first place, you know, because we've seen people die and we don't understand what happens. Like, wow, one minute he was here and the next minute he's just a lump of meat. And so there's just something about, we create rituals, we create ceremonies, we create gods and icons and all this stuff. Something in the human thing wants to make meaning.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense.
We're pattern seeking animals. And again, it was an evolutionary advantage to be a pattern seeking animal and recognize threats before they materialized and et cetera. So when we kind of, our brains got a little bit bigger, you know, too big for our britches, we were trying to see patterns in why the sun rose and set. And
pretty
you
sure
know
Doug
why
just admitted his brain is in his britches. But that's okay.
Boy, there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's never gotten me in trouble at all.
No, not at all.
But you know, we're up jumped apes. And so, you know, you see a comet in the sky that wasn't there ever before in your life. And you're trying to put some meaning to that and explain it.
Well, the next thing that happens after the comet is a couple months later, your wife turns up pregnant.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
So you make
the comet
connection.
Got her pregnant.
Right.
Or the crops failed or there was a flood or yeah.
Whatever. Do you guys remember the movie Quest for Fire?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah.
I do too. If you have a chance to look at that again, there's a scene where, and it's, you know, it's paleontologically wrong, but some saber-toothed cat or something is coming to attack them. And then these big mastodon elephants come and chase off the predator and save them. And so the people start to gather grass and offer it to the elephants. And that becomes a religious icon. These elephants came and chased off the tigers and saved us. So now this is going to be our God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have the same thing here in Utah, but it's with seagulls and crickets.
It's true. And the other flaw in that movie is that Daryl Hannah and Ron Perlman are not siblings. I'm sorry. That just is not the case. So,
I think that was a different movie with Daryl Hannah and Ron. I think that was the cave bear clan.
Oh, it was the clan of the guy. I'm mixing up my Paleolithic movie.
Ron Perlman was in Quest for Fire, though. He was.
Don Chong?
Was it Radon Chung? Maybe.
I think it was.
Have you seen that movie, Dan? Quest for Fire?
Left out. I haven't seen any of these.
It's so worth a watch. I can't believe that movie got made.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
And they filmed it like in northern Canada in freezing cold, and the people were pretty much naked the entire time every
day. So they wanted to quest for fire.
It's perfect. They needed fire for
Yeah.
So let's go back to Utah, and I have a funny story to tell you about that. But first, tell me about the Mormon afterlife.
Oh, so boy.
Doug, as the professional Mormon in the group, you probably ought to describe the tiers of Mormon heaven.
Can I draw it on a whiteboard as Mormons love to do? I'll give you the.
I could do that actually on Zoom.
give the elevator pitch.
Yeah, elevator pitch. Mormons believe that we were pre-existing spirits with God. We were sent here to this earth to be tested. That after we die, we will be resurrected to our peak physical form and then judged and sent to one of three levels of heaven, the celestial, terrestrial and telestial. I always forget which is which.
And there's some ante rooms to all of those.
Yeah, there's some ante rooms and there's a bunch of goings-ons. But basically, Joseph Smith said once that if you saw the lowest level of heaven, you would kill yourself to get in there. And the highest level of heaven is where men take many wives and, you know, have their own planets and their own universes to live over. Yeah. And it's really just, you know, it's like getting a guitar and putting another, you know, guitar on it. It's just heaven, but more so. You know what I mean?
Why do we want our own planet?
Well, Mormons believe that God was once upon a time a person, a man. I'm sorry, let me be very specific.
A
man like we are.
A mortal man, yeah.
And he progressed to his godhood, and then his purpose now is to rule over our universe. And that we, if we can, you know, pay our tithing and do the things that Mormons do, will end up in that position somewhere down the road, which would be governing a universe.
So, yeah, not just a planet, but actually, like, it was a 19th century version of a multiverse.
Yeah.
It is the most Mormon concept of all time, that the highest glory that you can achieve as a human being is a job in administration. I feel like that is about as Mormon.
That's so true.
And you know, that was evident in the document that you sent us about Mormons and their near-death experiences, because all of them managed to come up with the most boring possible afterlife, where everything is neatly organized and sort of carefully delineated.
And just like you said, it's a government job.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't feasting and fucking, right? It was, everybody knows their place. Everything's very orderly. Everything is administered properly. Everybody has a job.
It's calm. It's serene. It's
Mormon near-death experiences are as boring as Mormon life.
Yeah, it's hard to describe how absolutely devoid of color and joy and vibrancy is the Mormon upbringing and Mormon life.
So if I was talking to Mormons who reported their near-death experiences in that study, I would say to them, then why are these heavens so spectacular that you think are so great if all you do is shuffle papers all day?
So there was an interesting data point in what you sent us, Terry, and it was that these were old stories that were collected between 1852 and 1920. So I think what's really interesting about that period in Mormonism is that's near its founding. That's right after beginning right after they arrived in Utah, which was a very bleak place for them to arrive. There were not a lot of resources for them here. It's a high desert climate. So I think that the Mormons of that period were not only more vulnerable to a very particular magical worldview, but they were also mostly really poor. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So the Mormon immigrants who came here from the East Coast and from Europe, where they started to send the missionaries, were among kind of the lowest working classes, extremely poor immigrants who had no hope in Eastern cities like Baltimore and Philadelphia and New York. And so a guy comes to you and says, we'll go out west. You can be the master of your own kind of destiny. You can have all the land you can plow. You can get rich and you will have direct inspiration from God, which is different from the priest class of a lot of the Christian churches at the time, where you were never allowed to have any kind of direct revelation. And of course, this is just for men. So to me, these are the fantasies of people who not only saw the universe is very magical and the world is very kind of magical and mysterious, but also lived lives of kind of disorder and poverty. And so their heaven looked like order, hierarchy, and plenty.
Well, mm-hmm. And there's something about just human life, you know, especially, you know, when people are subject to, you know, if there's not enough rain, people will die. Or, you know, if a cougar comes into camp, somebody gets killed and there's nothing anybody can really do about it if it's going to happen. There's something about human powerlessness that I think is part of why religion exists as an answer to the concept of powerlessness. And I think Joseph Smith founding Mormonism, promising ultimate power at the end of this life, I think that there's something. I mean, even, you know, it's not like Mormons think of themselves in the afterlife as pushing papers around. They think of themselves as being, you know, omnipotent, omniscient gods.
Right.
And I think that the appeal to that, I don't know. It doesn't sound very appealing to me, from the universe is suddenly not interesting anymore perspective. But, you know, I think when you feel so powerless and so utterly helpless, to, you know, about stupid things, you know, you're going along just fine and somebody gets cancer and you got nothing. There's nothing we can do. So I think that promising that in the next life, you won't have to deal with any of that. You will have full control over your entire universe.
Well, that's why you can sell religion to the most vulnerable people.
Yeah.
So that's why
they're the only ones buying.
They're the ones behind it. And as Mark said, you know, in the early days of Mormonism, when people had nothing, you know, to promise them an acre of land would be tremendous, but mm-hmm. to promise them a whole planet and a whole universe would be
irresistible. It's huge, right? Well,
and it bears mentioning that Mormon heaven is polygamist. Mormons believe that now. They're not, polygamy as a practice was dispatched with in the late 1800s, more or less.
Yeah.
But Yeah, Mormon polygamous heaven is, or Mormon heaven is polygamous, and Mormons now believe that, to such that if you are a Mormon wife and you die, your husband can remarry, and in the next life, he's got both of you. But if you're a Mormon, if you're a Mormon woman and your husband dies and you remarry, when you die, you go back to your original husband, and that's that. I mean, obviously, that's all bullshit. It's psychologically damaging. But
hey, everybody who's got a shitty ex-husband, how exciting is that?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah,
which is almost every Mormon woman, I would imagine.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I would caution one other thing about these stories taken from people, not only that far back, but just kind of Mormons telling anecdotes generally. And I'm going to say this as delicately as I can. They're probably not true. They're probably not true memories. There is a testimonial habit and situation in Mormonism where you are expected under various circumstances to get up in front of all of your community and talk about your testimony of the church and to very often have an anecdote that backs it up. And they can become very competitively disingenuous. Am I saying that tenderly, guys?
Yeah, there's...
You're talking about testifying.
Yeah, but Mormons love to tell a tale. They love to spin a yarn about a faith-affirming event that happened in their lives.
Right.
And
or
it's,
that happened to someone that they know. Unnamed
person they know. And it's you know, called lying for the Lord, and it's very common practice. These anecdotes become so polished and practiced that I don't even know if, you know, there was ever a kernel of truth. I'm not even sure the person telling it knows whether they're lying or not anymore. But yeah, I think you're right, Uncle Mark, that it's such a common practice to say what you want, you think the flock wants to hear, and that makes you look like the most faithful person in the room, that, you know, the brain might just conjure that up subconsciously.
Well, it's like in any Christian cult, you know, it's your testimony of being saved. And I don't know if I heard this on your show or on Thank God I'm Atheist, but the whole thing about people speaking in tongues and the lady in the pink sparkly vest.
Oh, my God.
And that was
an amazing video.
That was so funny. And just so speaking in tongues is like that. Who's going to get up on stage and do a show right now for us?
Yeah, exactly. You
know? And at the twice yearly Mormon General Conference, where the people who call themselves the prophet and the 12 apostles in the same, they are the inheritors, according to themselves, of Jesus and the 12 apostles. They stand up in conference twice a year and tell stories that are undeniably bullshit about miracles and faith-affirming events. And it's just so enculturated into Mormonism. Like, look, if a Mormon dies and is revived, there has to be a story about it.
Yeah,
they
can't let that opportunity get away.
Right? Never let a crisis go to waste. So they can't just go home and say, oh my God, the doctor saved me. Thank God for modern medicine. Thank God for, you know, whatever adrenochrome they sucked out of children to give me. But they have to say something about it.
Yeah.
It's a testimony. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's like, oh, I saw a light, and beyond the light was Grandma Jenkins. And Grandma Jenkins told me, Mormon anecdotes like this are really never to be trusted. So
speaking of conference, I've been listening to you talk about that lately.
There's
a guy in Salt Lake City. I don't know, maybe you've heard of him. His name is Jeff O'Driscoll. He's an emergency room doctor. Does that name ring a bell at all?
No, I don't know Jeff.
He is either the official doctor of conference or one of the official doctors.
Okay.
And his job is to be there the whole time because so many of the leaders are really old.
Yeah.
And so he's there as an emergency room doctor to take care of them if they
that's interesting.
Have a heart attack. Yeah, Google this guy. His name is Jeff O'Driscoll. And there's another guy in Salt Lake City, also a practicing Mormon named Jeff, also Jeff, Jeff Olson.
Now, all of our doctors are named Jeff.
Apparently. So these two guys have they're still Mormons. They're still active in the church, but they both had these very interesting near-death experiences. I won't go into it in any detail, but just Google them. I'd love to hear what you think about them. And Jeff O'Driscoll was telling me when I was in Salt Lake City last time, I've been there a lot lately for some reason, about what it was like being the official doctor at conference. And basically he just sits there the whole time waiting for some old guy to have a cardiac arrest.
And so there's he's sitting next to an embalmer. And it just
pretty much
like, which one of them jumps up is just
like in a special part, like off to the side of the church or something.
I'll tell you, his experience does not differ that much from what mine was when I was a person who watched conference, which was I was just sitting there waiting for one of those guys.
Waiting for them to die. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like watching NASCAR. You just want to see a crash, right?
And it really is. It's just a plate full of nonagenarians. It is.
Yeah, the youngest people in leadership are late 60s.
Well, we've talked about this on the show. I mean, we won't have to go into too many details now, but the highest echelons of the Mormon Church are the 12 apostles and the first presidency. So there's 15 of them, and there's only ever a vacancy when one of them dies.
Right.
And I know that, you know, it's similar to popes, so to speak, except the cardinals
can
retire.
And the Supreme Court.
And the Supreme Court. But, you know, of a necessity, the people waiting in the wings are also very old.
The Supreme Court and the Vatican are equally Catholic. That's about true.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, so the upper echelon of the Mormon Church will always be extremely old. There's no way around
it. And out of touch for people their age.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they're not only people in their 90s. But there are people in their 90s that come out of a culture that is so retrograde and regressive that they really, their real age adjusted for culture is probably 150. Yeah. Wouldn't you guys say?
Yeah.
Do you think there's any hope that it will ever change or go away?
Well, in order to do that, it would have to.
Talking about this, yeah.
Yeah. The Book of Mormon is racially a minefield.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Disaster. It's also, it's an anachronistic and ridiculous. But it's full
of
things that
can't. It's also a painfully awful book.
It's also a terrible book, but it's full of things that cannot exist and be, you know, believed in a pluralistic, multiracial society, and that's true of many parts of Mormonism. So, in order for it to change to be not a force for bad, at least it would have to dispose of all those things, and then it's not even Mormonism anymore.
Well, we could say the same about the Bible, you know.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I think. You said, do you think it'll ever change or go away? It's going away.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the truth is that as society, and, you know, we talked about vulnerability before and how the vulnerable are the ones who are most buying into religious dogma. Our society every year gets a little bit more, and not just our society, just our world, humanity, gets a little bit more secure with each new, each new scientific breakthrough for energy or for, you know, there are just all these different ways in which we are actually making life a little bit safer, a little bit more secure for human beings. Still going to be a long time, but what we notice is in the countries that are doing the best, religiosity is nosediving.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah.
And so I think it will go away. I think as humanity becomes safer, more secure, more able to sort of, you know, fend for itself and feed itself and all this stuff, we'll start to see less and we will continue to see less and less religiosity.
Mormonism is in a weird spot where it is hemorrhaging young people. Its massive missionary program with at least, what did we figure, guys? 60,000 missionaries at any one time out in the field on two-year missions that they pay for themselves to sell this thing door to door.
And you all went on missions, right? All of
only
you?
Doug.
Just me.
Oh, only Doug. Okay.
Yeah. The rest of us got out beforehand.
So they're in a weird space with, even with all that, they're getting no traction in the place they want traction, which is North America, Northern Europe. You know, let's just be honest, the white parts of the world. And they're getting some traction in what's loosely referred to as the Global South, which is not the kind of community that older Mormons would really want to be part of their church. So it's collapsing in strange ways, but it has
also managed its properties and resources in such a way that it is a, it may be the wealthiest church in the world.
More than the Vatican.
Probably.
In liquid assets, it's
hundreds of billions.
One of the wealthiest organizations on the face of the earth.
I mean, so it's
outrageous.
It's going to run out of members long before it runs out of money. So what is that thing anymore?
Yeah, when a religion isn't reliant on its membership for
tithing.
They take tithing, and it is a solid 10%, and it is supposed, and they are adamant about it.
10% of gross, yeah.
Of your gross income. But and if they never got another penny from a believer,
oh yeah,
wouldn't matter.
Fine. So
it'd still be. Yeah.
Who knows what's going on with them?
And here's the thing, and this is doctrinal: the last living Mormon gets it all. So
eventually,
he who dies with the most stuff wins. That
I got to get on the treadmill. I'll see you guys.
it's like the Highlander. Everybody, you're going to start to see Mormons with swords.
Wait a minute, is that really doctrinal?
No, I made that one up.
That was pretty good. You had me hooked there for a minute. I mean, we know that, you know, there's a lot of research. The Pew Research studies are showing that I can't quote the number right now, but, you know, 25-30% of people, you know, have left the religion of their childhood or whatever. It would take a lot of young people to get out of Mormonism for that to change. But how can the young people do that when they're so indoctrinated and people have so many kids that they're indoctrinating?
Well, I'll tell you what, and this is, Mormonism is so behind the moment. We're having a moment right now. You know, we went through some really unbelievably rapid movement in the LGBTQ rights movement in the last several years. We're going through a racially charged moment of equal velocity right now. The Mormon Church is so outpaced for that, so not up to that moment. If you're a millennial or younger, and you have no problem with LGBTQ community people. You have no problem with people of color. You have no problem with immigrant communities. The Mormon Church is just
the opposite of you.
It's a trench coat, you know, and it's just so easy to walk out of now that they're not shedding.
Not only that, but also Mormonism for most of its history relied incredibly heavily on the fact that no one could challenge their truth claims.
Exactly.
And then Al Gore invented the internet.
They got an internet out there, and boy, howdy, you know, all it takes is one sort of burning question that you want an answer to, and you are on that slippery slope out the door.
Well, that's the beautiful thing that we have now. I mean, nobody can challenge any religion's truth claims without the ability to do intense research, which most people do not have the ability to do. So the truth claims have been spread throughout the world by, you know, barefoot beggars going door to door, pitching whatever religion they happen to be pitching. And nobody can challenge it because communities weren't in touch with other communities, you know? Right. And so you just had this one, you had Paul going across the Roman Empire, selling everybody on this idea. They weren't in touch with people from China and South America. They had no way of knowing what other people thought. Actually, they were in touch with people from the East because they had the Silk Road.
And yeah, but what was the literacy rate at the time? Like, it was
exactly,
even if there were things to read, nobody could read them.
And information traveled at the speed of someone walking.
Yeah, exactly.
The speed of someone
walking. The speed of sandal.
So I got to tell you a funny story. I actually emailed this to you guys a while ago. And so, you know, I run this thing called the Afterlife Conference, where we have like researchers and, you know, theologians and people coming in just talking about different views of the afterlife from different religions. And we had it in Salt Lake City in 2019. Did you know that? Did I tell you that?
I didn't realize it was that recent. I think
it was very recent.
Yeah.
And we were at, I think it was a Ramada or a Radisson, a few blocks down the street from the temple.
Yeah.
And so when the conference was over on Sunday afternoon, about 10 of us decided to go take a tour of the Mormon temple. And so we went there and we went through the exhibits.
Yeah.
And we were just...
You're so convinced, right, sister? Welcome.
I was like speechless. And at one point, there was a family, tons of families there. And this little kid, about 5, for some reason, comes running over to us and decides to give us a tour. of the exhibits. And he goes, and these are the actual nails that were nailed through Jesus's hands to the cross.
Oh my.
And we're like, really? These are the real ones? And he's like, yes, these are the real ones. And he's showing us. And then eventually his family found him and called him back. And the next thing we did was we went out into the courtyard, and they have all these like little students walking around that have like a badge that says,
oh, those are the sister missionaries. They're like velociraptors. If you don't move, they can't see you.
Oh my God.
Just got to stand fucking still.
Mark, actually, that was the T-Rex.
Is that the T-Rex? So these two girls see us sitting there. And now we had this amazing crew of people. We had a Hawaiian shaman who was a very tall man wearing a what they call a sulu. It's like a sarong mm-hmm. that men wear. And we had a couple of Native Americans. We had a guy from Kenya. I mean, we really stood out like a sore thumb there. And these two girls come up to us and ask us who we are. And we start talking to them. So we asked them to tell us about the Mormon afterlife. And they tell us that, well, if you're really, really good and you completely embrace the religion, you go to the realm of the sun. And if you're sort of good and you kind of are into Jesus, but not all that much, you go to the realm of the
moon.
The moon. Okay. Right. And then the next one, if you're like a total piece of shit, you go to the realm of the stars.
Right.
So she's telling us this. And we said to her, you do know that the sun is a star. Right.
They don't know that.
So no, they don't know that.
Yeah.
And so the other part of this, I apologize for being so long-winded, is one of the guys who was with us is a man named Peter Panagore. You could Google him. He had a near-death experience. He was a mountain climber, pack tour leader, and he died on this mountaintop somewhere. And he was dead. He froze to death and they helicoptered him somewhere. And then he was revived. And he has this whole story of what it was like to die, of like, you know, the world just kind of closed like an aperture into this little dot. And then all this other stuff happened. So he tells these two little Mormon girls his story. And he was pretty long-winded. And they stood there and they listened drop-jawed to his afterlife. And then when we left, we were like, oh, these poor little girls. They went back to their dorm and told their friends about these freaks that they met, and they'll never be the same. Or will they? I mean, what would they have made of us?
You honestly, you are wildly underestimating a Mormon's ability to just tune it out.
Yeah, I wondered about that. That's why
Have you seen the Book of Mormon musical, the play?
I've seen snippets of it. I haven't actually seen it. I've seen whatever I can find online.
There's a great song that you probably know, which just speaks to the absolute heart of the Mormon intellectual process, called Turn It Off.
Oh, right. Okay.
Or if there's just anything that troubles you, it's like a light switch, you just turn it off.
Yeah. Yep. If you've got a nagging doubt in the back of your mind or an attraction to someone of the same sex, you just turn it off.
Yep.
So if you meet a bunch of freaks touring the temple one day and they tell you a bunch of different stuff, just turn it off.
They were there to test your faith.
Here's the thing, Terry, is you never know the seed you plant.
That's true. And
true.
Yeah. One day down the road, that seed might flower and they'll be like, you know what? That got to me. That made me research. It made me Google something that sent me down a path. You never know.
What a pipe dream that is. Yeah. It would be nice if those girls.
Although I will say this. I you know, Frank, who co-hosts Thank God I'm Atheist with me, told me that he, when he was on his mission in Rome, there was a guy, you know, Mormons are sticklers about diet. You know, they have this word of wisdom that says you can't drink, you can't smoke, you can't blah 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 blah, all these different rules.
That a girl.
and Frank was there, and a guy, you know, he and his companion were talking to a guy on the street, and he pointed to a homeless man and he said, you would do more good for him to give him a cigarette than you would do to teach him about your stupid religion. And for whatever reason, that stuck with Frank for a while and was one of the needles that sort of rattled around in his brain for a while. I think we don't know what the effects of any of something that you say is.
Exposure. In the former Mormon community, we call it our shelf. And you put doubts and problematic things on your shelf and you try not to think about it, but one day the shelf breaks.
I heard, was that you, Doug, talking
yeah.
about?
Yeah, he, Doug was talking breaking? About that. Yeah.
If
that
it was a good, if it was a good segment, it was me.
It was, and I think I even posted a comment about how much I like that shelf breaking story.
Yeah, yeah. And it sometimes it could be the smallest little thing that is the thing that breaks it. You know, you put some pretty titanic things up there, but it, you know, it could be just a feather that one little doubt could break the whole thing. You never know.
Oh, wow. Well, I could talk to you guys for hours and hours and hours, and I don't want to keep you much longer, but I have so many things I want to say to you, but
well, we're happy to come back anytime.
Really? Well, oh, yeah. Gosh, I just love you so much. And this is so great. Oh, let me just ask you one last question. So actually I'm going to go off on something else. There is this thing in the Bible from Paul, I think it's in Romans, where he says, as a good Christian, you should never grieve when somebody dies. I don't know the exact passage, but it says, you know, you shall not grieve as others because you know the kingdom of heaven. So you know that when your mother or your husband or whoever dies, that they're going to be with Jesus and don't grieve. So there's this really awful thing that happens with a lot of Christians dealing with loss and death is that they shut down their emotions and they don't process their grief and they feel guilty for feeling sad because their wife died or whoever. I imagine that Mormons with that kind of heaven schema must have something similar to that.
Oh, they are professionals at that. The thing at that grieving? You just described, yeah. I have been at a Mormon funeral where it was made explicit over the pulpit. This is sort of in the Mormon chapel that no one should be crying.
Wow.
I've like it. It is a mindfuck of epic proportions. The way that Mormons culturally, it's not even necessarily theological. It's just this cultural sense that, you know, that, yeah, it's a betrayal of your belief if you're sad about this person going. And everything that they say, he's gone to a better place or, you know, God needed another angel or any of these sort of notions that are supposed to be the comforting things that people say. They're the least comforting. It is just adding to suffering.
You don't have to be Mormon to have that add right. to your mm-hmm. suffering. That goes across the board for everybody.
I've been to a couple, probably more than a couple funerals of young Mormons who were queer or in one case was had a lot of mental illness who committed suicide. Young people, I'm talking about like 18, 19, 20. And the attitude at the funeral was almost giddy, was joyful, that they're no longer an embarrassment. They now are, as they say, finishing their mission in Israel. So they're just, I went with some non-Mormon friends who also knew a couple of these people that were horrified by what they saw going down. And it wasn't like laughing, but it wasn't mournful. It was celebratory. It was like, finally, they're free of their. Exactly. And it's
denying
gruesome.
Emotion, denying your own actual emotional journey is part and parcel of Mormonism. There is an expected amount of joy that you're supposed to feel. You know, Mormon women, Utah County, which is where Provo, Utah is.
It's the most Mormon part of the country.
The most Mormon part of the country.
Yeah.
Is also renowned for having the highest per capita use of antidepressants because it is absolutely vital that a Mormon woman, and this is actually more women than men, that a Mormon woman is chipper and happy at all times.
Right. She has to behave.
And she has to show the world how good Mormonism has.
Are they
everything's
allowed
perfect.
To take
everything's
antidepressants?
Perfect. Yeah.
That? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, if they're prescribed. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the doctor's note is a get out of the word of wisdom free card.
But also there's a huge opioid addiction problem. It is so painful. And onerous the pressures, the societal pressures put on these people.
It's true of both men and women, but I think it's way worse for women.
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah.
So just
it is, yeah, it's astounding.
Rushing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and funerals are just sort of the worst.
And look, a woman is outranked by her son on his 12th birthday.
I heard that from you. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he gets the Aaronic priesthood, whether he wants it or not, on his 12th birthday. And at that point, technically in the Mormon universe, she is subservient to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, like, if a child dies, if your child gets run over by a car at 5 years old, you're not supposed to.
Well, that's a mitzvah because that child is getting their own planet because they died before the age of 8.
So yep. You're supposed to be before what happens at, so there's a difference between before eight.
That's the age of accountability.
Well, so right. Yeah, you know, the Catholic belief that a child who dies before baptism,
right?
You know, but it's in every case in Catholicism, it's an infant. Well, Mormons. Wait till you're 8 because they're enlightened.
They're kind of Anabaptists in that way that they think that you're, you know, the Anabaptist thing was no, you can't make these eternal choices until you're old enough to make these choices. And so it's for Mormons, it's 8.
Yeah, you so what if the child is 12? You were 8.
Well, he's been baptized and now he's got some issues. Yeah.
So we're all happy when children die. Basically,
are you asking me?
I don't know.
Theologically, yes. Theologically, yes.
Theologically,
yes. I think people are allowed to cry, and they're allowed to, you know, I don't want to paint a false picture. It's not like people don't mourn.
They're not monsters. They
mourn more than an expected amount, there's something wrong with them.
There's something particularly bizarre and not in an exotic or interesting way about Mormon funerals and Mormon weddings. They are nearly indistinguishable from each other.
Hmm.
They have the same cuisine and they take place on a basketball court for some reason. yeah. But they are both very muted affairs. The emotion at a funeral and the emotion at a wedding, one is supposed to be, you know, terrible and sad, and one is supposed to be full of joy and excitement. Both of them are somewhere in the middle on Valium. They're just, you know, dreadfully kind of painless and joyless affairs. It's
so
odd.
The actual human beings that are at this wedding and this funeral are human beings, and they have these emotions, and because they have to suppress them, just makes them all that much more neurotic.
Being Mormon is no bueno. It's not fun. Yeah. It's a miserable life. I'm sorry, it is.
I hope we've talked some of the listeners into it out there. I just
because we are starting a cult. Don't forget.
Email me your information, and I can have two young guys on bicycles at your place in 15 minutes.
You know, everybody used to tell me if those guys come to your door, make them a sandwich.
I think starving. That's the right thing to do.
I think you should be kind.
Listen to their sales pitch. Just say, hey, if you want to come in and have a sandwich and use
just feed them because they're hungry, aren't they? They're like five guys in an apartment. They have
they're poor and hungry. Yeah.
They're starving.
Starving. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and kindness, even kindness and especially kindness from someone who's not part of their group might be one of those seeds that shows flower one day down the road.
You know what? If one of them came to my door, and they never do because I live way out in the middle of nowhere and nobody can find me, but I would love to have a couple of those boys come into my house and make them a nice meal and help them with their grief.
They would never forget that. I promise you.
I think it's okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our time. I love you guys so much. And I am so grateful for you sharing your time with me today. And you're going to be something brand new for my listeners. And I just know that they're going to want to know you. Some of them may not like you that much.
But that's all right.
Hey, that's the way it is.
Not everybody does.
Some of them don't like me that much. So
make the check out to the How To Heretic. And
Yes, give us a little pitch on the How To Heretic, please. Seriously. Tell Uncle us how Mark. To find you.
Yeah. So you can find us at howtoheretic.com is our website. We're on all the pod blasters like Stitcher and iTunes and Spotify as the How To Heretic. And our show is non-sequential. You don't have to listen from the beginning. You can jump in at any point. We cover all kinds of topics. We have a search function on our website. If you're looking for something very specific, we've done about 500 different segments at this point. So there's probably a flavor you might like in all that.
And I will put all that stuff in the show notes, of course. So
thank you so much, Dr. Terry. Yeah, thank you. It's been a delight.
Thank you, you guys. I love you to pieces, and I will see you in cyberspace.
I love you back. Thanks,
everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.